Blog Talk Radio.
I know, I know, I know, I never.
Welcome, everybody, to the Dragon's Lair on Renegade Broadcasting, the best source for factual information on the planet. Tonight's topics, time allowing, will be Dionysus, Alexandria in Christianity, the Arya Nagas of the ancient Americas, communism's Christian roots, Adolf Hitler, man of peace, the Jewish communist genocide of Russia and Eastern Europe, the Jewish communizing of America. Now, I don't know how much time all of that is going to take. I just want to make sure I had enough. If I don't finish all of the articles, then I'll do it on another show. And if it gets to the point where time is starting to run out, I'll make a decision on where I'm at in a particular article. If I'm near the end, I'll go ahead and go into to the archives for a little bit. If I'm halfway through it, I'll just go ahead and end the show and pick it up on another one. I don't want to go 3 hours tonight. I have stuff I have to do. So I'm going to try and keep it around 2 hours. For the record, today is July 14th, 2013 on our screwed up Christian calendar. The sun is at 23 degrees Cancer. Uranus goes retrograde on Wednesday. Mercury is still retrograde until next Saturday, which is the 20th. Be sure and give a listen to all of the other hosts here on Renegade. We have Kyle on Mondays, Lou on Tuesdays, Dana on Wednesdays, Mike on Thursdays, Siegfried on Fridays, Roundtable is on Saturdays, and me, of course, on Sundays. I want to monitor the chat. May take a peek at it during music breaks, smoking and drinking here. Occasional silence for clearing my throat or a cough. We have a chat at renegadebroadcasting.com, and I believe we have a stream there tonight. We also have the same chat at renegadebroadcasting.chatango.com. And we have the same chat over at alternativesocial.com. I want to remind everybody about nationalprotectionism.com. Again, I have no website or blog. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com, and that's magus_18@geocities.com. No calls tonight. And if you want to be on my email list, you can just write me and say subscribe. If you just want to write me otherwise, just send me an email. I can't guarantee I can get to all of them. The dog's here on the floor next to me, and the cat is on the chair behind me. She's actually hanging around me tonight. I want to mention that I'm going to be doing some extra shows this week on my own Blog Talk account, and that is Dragons-Layer, Blog Talk Radio, whatever syntax is. So anyway, Eric will be on one of them, and I'm going to try and do at least two, hopefully three. We'll see how it goes, and I'm not sure what days or times just yet. And I still have not forgotten about doing an architecture show. I just want to let everybody know about that. I've got to be in kind of in the right mood to discuss the issue. And kind of depends on whatever else is going on at the same time that might be influencing what I may say on the show. But I will get to it. I have not forgot. Just want to let everybody know. And you know, I do want to get back to the topic of guns briefly in one of the upcoming shows. Just not sure which one yet. So I still have a little bit of information I would like to say about that. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play a short song, and we'll get into these articles I've got tonight. So I'll be right back. We'll be right back. Okay. First article I have is called Dionysus Alexandria in Christianity. And this letter or email, came about as a topic on a discussion regarding Ark and the Ark and Seraphim and similar things such as that. So, again, this is a response, and so you have to kind of understand when I'm reading this that they're replying to somebody. So, anyway, let me get started. It says, you can see they knew this even back in the days of Da Vinci and before, as Moses was painted with horns, which is what Bacchus was always shown with in many images. Da Vinci himself also painted John the Baptist as Dionysus, as he knew that is who John the Baptist of the Bible was taken from, as John the Baptist was originally a title for Oannes, O-A-N-N-E-S, or Oanna, O-A-N-A, or John in Greek, the Baptist. Baptist means the same as Baphomet. Oannes, or Oanna, is shown in the meaning in the root of the term gnosis. There is no Jew-Exian Christian Gnosticism. The Alexandrian Gospels were all pseudo-Gnosticism, which was created by the Jewish therapeutes to counterfeit the appearance of the appearances of the pagan religions in their sacred schools. That is how subversion works. When they go to the next level of their program, they created the Bible and destroyed the original counterfeit text of the first wave of their agenda. Today, New Age Christian kooks actually believe, because they found some first wave text, that somehow that makes Christianity and Jesus real. The fact is, the same group of Jews who made those texts are the ones who made the Bible and swept the early ones under the rug as they left a trail of evidence they did not want found. I should mention that Oannes, which is Ea in Sumeria, was also Dionysus to the Hellenics, and the cauldron he carried was called the Horn of Plenty, or the Agathodemon. I believe the Agathodemon was also referring directly to Dionysus as the Good Serpent, which was an ancient title for the Sol God, S-O-L. The Cathars, who worshipped the Good Serpent, or Agathodemon, in Dionysus' temples, had wooden chests in which sacred serpents were kept and honored as part of the rites, and during the holy days, python serpents that were recorded as being as large as up to 40 feet were carried through the towns and the cities. The Christian Holy Spirit is a stolen and corrupted concept from the Dionysius mysteries, where the Holy Spirit was that of Dionysus, an activated power within you that would give you eternal life and perfection, because it is symbolic of the Kundalini life force, which Dionysus, as the soul god, symbolizes. The soul god is also the concept of the inner sun or soul, again, S-O-L, where we get the word soul, S-O-U-L, from. His wine is the ether. The rite of communion with the bread and wine comes from this pagan religion, which was also practiced in ancient Egypt and elsewhere. The pagans constantly noted and told the Christians that Christianity was nothing but a Jew counterfeit of their pagan religions. It was so obvious. Augustine, who recanted and admitted Christianity was a hideous lie at the end of his life, okay, came up with the bullshit lie of the Christian devil did it defense to try to cover it over, a bullshit lie to cover for a bullshit lie. Christianity did not get anywhere within the Roman Empire because of the texts that survived show, in parentheses, only about 50,000 members in an empire of 60 million people. The Gentiles of the Roman Empire all knew Christianity was Jewish bullshit, and they knew that the pagan religions were symbolic sciences, not literal tales, and the fact that Christianity was pushing their ripoff as literal made them all the more clownish to the Gentiles. Okay, I just want to mention here real quick that there's a potential for some thunderstorms here. And it's not in the forecast, but I can hear thunder right now as I speak. So hopefully I won't lose power. But where I live, I have a habit of losing power at the least, for the least reason, possible reason. So anyway, if I do, I'll try to get back into the show as quick as I can. And now if it's at the end, I may just call it quits. But anyway, where was I at? Okay. CELEUS. I've mentioned that name before. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. CELEUS called the Christians buffoons or buffoons, and the Emperor Julian the throat slitters. Many philosophers and writers of this period all state the same, that Christianity led and organized. It was led and organized out of the Jewish communities funded by Jews, and the Romans called Christianity openly a sect of Judaism. The Emperor Julian wrote an entire book debunking this scam in his day. The Christians murdered him. The Romans also wrote that only among the Gentiles did the most stupid, basically the village idiots, bought into Christianity. And when a learned man would appear at the market, the Christian propagandists would make scare and appear once. It was only the... Okay, let me make sure I'm reading what he's saying correctly here. And when a learned man would appear at the market, the Christian propagandists would make scare and appear once. It was only the educated dregs around to push the lies again. Once they had political power, they just murdered anyone with an IQ above a houseplant that didn't go along to themselves and their families alive, and even most of them were killed away. I'm not sure that made a lot of sense. Anyway, I'll move on. Constantine helped pave the way with his destruction of most of the philosopher schools and temples and put the Jewish Christian terror machine base into power. Later, it was Theodosius who initiated the Pol Pot-style cultural revolution of Jew-Christianity in the Roman Empire fully after several decades of Khmer Rouge-like slaughtering and destruction. The empire fell apart from within and was over forever. Let's see here. There was something in parentheses that I skipped over. In that first sentence where it said most of the philosopher schools and temples put the Jewish Christian terror machine base into power. It says love of the light of the serpent in English. That was after philosopher. Okay, Paul of Tarsus, apostle who preached to Greeks in the fictional Bible, is stolen from Apollonius of Tyana. Apollonius was also called Paulus or Paul and started his ministry in Tarsus, traveling the empire, preaching the word of the good god Apollo and working miracles and even being imprisoned by the emperor before escaping by supernatural ability, etc. The tales are identical. To state further, the Cathars had the same religion as the Hellenics, and so did the Germanics and Vedics in the east. Hellenic just means shining ones, which is a common title of the Aryans. Now, that pretty much ends this. I'm not going to read the original email that was a reply to. I'm going to go ahead and move on to the next article, which is called The Arya Nagas of the Ancient Americas. Now, I read this a long time ago, so it's been a good while since I've read this. But anyway, I thought it would kind of tie into some of what Kyle has been doing on his shows. And at some point, I'll do something on the Templar Serpent as well. So anyway, this is called The Arya Serpents of the Ancient Americas. After the destruction of the Aryan homeland, a branch of the Arya Serpents moved into the Americas. 1994, and this is what the author is saying, I saw a newspaper article that showed a photograph of a huaco, H-U-A-C-O, which is something that is which is an ancient pot, usually made of clay, and from the Inca culture or older. The sign that appeared on this huaco was a big swastika with four dots inside. The Viracochas, the race of the white gods. The conquistador Pedro Pizarro reported in his account of the great Spanish invasion of South America in the 1500s that while the masses of Andes Indians were small and dark, the members of the ruling Inca family were tall and had whiter skins than the Spaniards themselves. He mentions in particular certain individuals in present-day Peru who were white and had red hair. Heyerdahl, H-E-Y-E-R-D-A-H-L, reported that this is reflected in the mummies found in South America. On the Pacific coast, in the desert sand of Paracas, there are large burial caves in which numerous mummies have been perfectly preserved. Some of the mummies were found to have the stiff black hair of the Indians, while others, which have been kept in the same conditions, have red, often chestnut-colored hair, silky and wavy, as found amongst Europeans. They have long skulls and remarkably tall bodies. Hair experts have shown by microscopic analysis that the red hair has all the characteristics that ordinarily distinguish a Nordic hair type from that of the Mongols or American Indians. Pizarro asked who the white-skinned redheads were. The Inca Indians replied that they were the last descendants of the Viracochas. The Viracochas, they said, were a divine race of white men with beards. They were so like the Indians were called Viracochas the moment they came to the Inca Empire. The Incas thought they were the Viracochas who had come sailing back across the Pacific. And that was written by Heyerdahl. According to the principal Inca legend, before the reign of the first Inca, the sun god, Contiki Viracocha, had taken leave of his kingdom in present-day Peru and sailed off into the Pacific with all of his subjects. The entire American landmass was anciently known as Amaruca, the land of the immortals, or the land of the wise serpents, or land of the feathered serpents, or plumed serpents. And that's where we also get the name America from, not Amerigo Vespucci. Total bullshit. They taught that crap to me in school. What are they hiding? Hello? The title is derived from the Quechuan Sanskrit word Amaru, meaning snake or serpent. Quechuan, and that's Q-U-E-C-H-U-A-N, I think I'm pronouncing that right, is descended from the Sanskrit language. Professor Ramon Mena, curator of the National Museum of Mexico, said the general appearance of Maya's writings is considered of Orient origin. According to scholar Erazo Vibera, Maya and other languages are of Sanskrit origin. Sanskrit, and he's got in brackets here, Sanskrit is the original language of the Aryan race and the root languages of all Indo-European languages today. H.P. Blavatsky maintains in The Secret Doctrine that America is referred to in the Hindu Puranas as Patala, P-O-T-A-L-A, the kingdom of the Nagas, and Nagas means serpents. According to the principal Inca legend, before the reign of the first Inca, the sun god, Contiki Viracocha, had taken leave of his kingdom in present-day Peru. Okay, this guy put this in here twice, so I already said that. Typo. Anyway, and he says here, guess who built all of the ancient megalith sites like the famous Machu Picchu in the Aryan Viracochas? When the Spaniards came to Lake Titicaca up in the Andes, they found the mightiest ruins in all of South America, Tiahuanaco. They saw a hill reshaped by man into a stepped pyramid, classical masonry of enormous blocks, beautifully dressed and fitted together, and numerous large statues in human form. They asked the Indians to tell them who had left these enormous ruins. The well-known chronicler Cieza de Leon was told in reply that these things had been made long before the Incas came to power. They were made by white and bearded men like the Spaniards themselves. And that was also by Heyerdahl. The white man had finally abandoned their statues and gone with the leader, Contiki Viracocha, first up to Cuzco and then down to the Pacific. They were given the Inca name of Viracocha, or sea foam, because they were white-skinned and vanished like foam over the sea. And then he's got something here on the Inca royal houses, but I'm going to light a cigarette before I read that part of it. Hold on just one second. And I'm going to go ahead and clear my throat while I'm taking this short little pause. Okay, the Spaniards recorded that the ruling Inca families called themselves Oriones. I guess it's a Oriones, O-R-E-J-O-N-E-S, or long ears. In contrast to their subjects, Pizarro pointed out that it was especially the long ears who were white-skinned. And that, again, was written by Heyerdahl. Bernardo de Sahagún, S-A-H-A-G-U-N, a Franciscan monk who arrived in Mexico following the Spanish conquest and became the official historian for his people through numerous conversations with the Nahuatl, N-A-H-U-A-T-L, old people, is what it means. He learned that the forefathers of the Mesoamericans were serpents who came from the direction of what is today Florida, and in the direction of the east as well, he says. They came sailing across the coast and disembarked in the port of Panuco. In their colonizing party were wise old men who had all the writings, the books, the paintings, which they had carried with them from their homeland. These serpents proceeded to build a city called Tamoancan, T-A-M-O-A-N-C-H-A-N, Tamoancan, which means the place where the people of the serpent landed. Edward Thompson, a United States consul and archaeologist who was sent to Mexico, was able to elaborate on the arrival of the early Americans. Mesoamerican serpent colonists, the source of which came from certain Mayan brotherhoods. Thompson learned the meaning of Tamoancan was the place where the people of the serpent landed, and as Sahagún had recorded many years earlier, the ancient city had been built along the banks of the Panuco River, the entrance to which was near Tuxpan, T-U-X-P-A-N, on the Veracruz coast. And that is eastern Mexico, by the way. East of Mexico City, approximately, in the Gulf of Mexico. The founders of the port city, Thompson learned, were the Canes, C-H-A-N-E-S, or people of serpents, who arrived in vessels possessing sides which shone like the scales of serpents' skins, and to simple natives who saw them appeared to be great serpents coming swiftly towards them. Upon disembarking, these serpents appeared to be clad in strange garments, and they wore about their foreheads emblems like entwined serpents. The wondering natives who met them at the shore saw the manner of their coming with the symbol of the sacred serpent, which they, meaning the Viracochas, wore on their brows. The Tamoancan also means in the Mayan vernacular, the land of the plumed serpent. These serpents became the priest kings and spiritual masters and forebearers of the Mayan Olmec, Toltec, and Aztec civilizations. Another Mexican portacal of the ancient serpents was Balum, or Valum, V-A-L-U-M, Valum Votan. According to the Spanish chroniclers, this was where Pakal Votan, which means he of the serpent lineage, disembarked with his crew after sailing down the Usumacinto River of the Yucatan Peninsula. Apparently, Pakal's arrival occurred at such an early period in the history of Mexico that later historical texts remembered him as one of the first patriarchs in the Americas. In reference to him, for example, he was called the first man on the Yucatan whom God has sent to parcel out the land which is known as America. After coming ashore at Belum Votan, Pakal and his robed serpent's entourage traveled inland to a specially selected site and constructed the holy city of Palenque. After installing himself as the priest king of the new empire, Pakal Votan served his Mexican subjects for many years, both as a teacher and monarch. When he died, he was honorably interred in a pyramid, which is known today as the Temple of Inscriptions. Pakal authored an autobiography within which he included a detailed description of his obscure origins. The text survived for thousands of years, but was finally destroyed in a fire in 1691 by the fanatic Christian bishop of Chiapas, Nunez de la Vega. They burn and destroy everything in their path. Fortunately, salient pints of the manuscript were preserved by a certain brother Ordonez, who would later record in his diary that Pakal Votan had come from the land of the Valum Chicam, Chicm, and arrived in Mexico. Anyway, the dwelling of the 13 serpents. I think he meant to say, and arrived in Mexico and called the dwelling of the 13 serpents, called the land. The long-suppressed white origins of much of what has been regarded as Native American Indian culture is apparent from the finds in the Paracas burial ground in Peru. One of the most famous ancient wonders of the South American continent are the huge emblems of the Nazca Plains in Peru, which have been dated at approximately 500 BCE. The emblems, many only properly visible from the air, are usually attributed to the Nazca Indians, but in fact the well-preserved bodies of the Nazca upper classes and priests have been uncovered in the neighboring Paracas region. And of the 400 old mummies uncovered so far, virtually all of them are clearly white in racial origin, with red hair being prominent. Let me relight this. Another famous serpent colonist of the Yucatan, remembered in the historical records of the Mesoamerica, is Itzamna, 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 a name which means dragon, and iguana house, also known as the serpent of the east. Itzamna was the ancient patriarch of the Itza Mayas and the son of Hunab Ku, the great spirit. His symbol was the Ta cross, T-A-U cross, symbol of the breath of life and the serpent son of God. According to the Mayan books of Chilam Balam and the history of Zadzil by Juan de Regosa, a work which is based upon a text entitled The Unedited Documents Relating to the Discovery and Conquest of New Spain, meaning Mesoamerica, Itzamna and his people, the Azanul, the people of the serpent, were the first to populate the Yucatan after the flood. And he's got in here parentheses Atlantis. Itzamna and the Acanule first settled on the island of Cozumel before migrating to the Yucatan mainland and constructing the cities of Chichen Itza, Izamal, Ake, and Uzamal. I'm not going to spell those. You've all have heard of them. Of Itzamna, it is remembered, he was the one who gave names to all the rivers and divisions of the land. He was the first priest and taught them the proper rites wherewith to please the gods and appease their ill will. He was the patron of the healers and diviners, and was disclosed to them, and had disclosed to them the mysterious virtues of plants. It was Itzamna who first invented the characters or letters in which the Mayas wrote their numerous books. Quetzalcoatl, which is another name for Toth or Toth, or Kulkan, a culture bearer whose name means plumed serpent, and whose symbol, like Itzamna's, is the Tau Cross, and it's T-A-U again, and his band of missionaries left a trail of megalithic cities and pyramids. When his work was accomplished, Quetzalcoatl is reputed to have boarded a dragon-shaped vessel covered with snake skins and left Mexico in the direction from which he had come. The evidence of a serpent dynasty, perhaps even more ancient than Tomoanacan, was discovered in Mexico by a Frenchman named Augustus Leplongeon, the first Western archaeologist to study the Mayan culture and ruins of Mesoamerica. Leplongeon claims to have been led by Mayan natives through the jungles of Mexico to a mausoleum near Chichen Itza, within which the remains of King Coh, C-O-H-E, I'm sorry, C-O-H, an ancient king of the Khan, C-A-N, or Serpent Dynasty. Covering the mausoleum walls were serpentine motifs of the chronology of the long history of the archaic Khan Dynasty, C-A-N. One such motif depicted King Ka, C-O-H, engulfed with the protective coils of a 12-headed serpent, Nanoka Khan, the totem animal of the Khan Dynasty. An archaeologist named Niven, on excavation in an area between Texcoco and Jalupantla, H-A-L-U-E-P-A-N-T-L-A, between Texcoco and Jalupantla, Niven found over 20,000 stone tablets which were covered with unusual symbols, some of which were identical to the ones that Churchward had seen on the Nakal tablets in India, and that's N-A-C-C-A-L. Since the Mexican tablets were found in conjunction with the remains of the three buried rooms, the first of which was estimated by Niven to have belonged to a civilization which had existed at least 50,000 years ago, they were apparently synchronous, S-Y-N, C-H-R-O-N-O-U-S, synchronistic with, and perhaps relics of, the ancient Khan Dynasty. I can't say that word. One direct culture that descended directly from the Aryan Viracochas were the Maya. According to the notes of Edward Thompson of the Tomoacan, or the Viracochas, they traveled to the Yucatan, where interbreeding with the Mongoloid races over time produced the Mayan culture. The city-states it thus engendered were administered by priest-kings and sages known as serpent priests or kukulkans, or plumed serpents. The Mayan serpent priesthood was made up of a hierarchical ladder. We got another typo here. The Mayan priesthood was made up of a hierarchical ladder and were classes of priests intimately involved with Mayan sacrifices, the Nacoms and the Chascs, and that's N-A-C-O-M-S and C-H-A-S-C-S. These priests superintended the sacrifice of plants, minerals, and animals. Above the two Balaams, the jaguar priest, the Balaams were keepers of the sacred records. Their historical recollections were compiled into a series of sacred texts known as the Books of Chilam Balaam. Near the top of the Mayan sacerdotal ladder, Sacerdotal, where the chief priest, known as the Ahuakanmai, Ahuakanmai, or serpent priest in the Akinmi, and that's Akinmii, or solar priest. They were the main officiates of Mayan religious ceremony and oversaw all sacrifices and initiations. At the pinnacle of the Mayan spiritual hierarchy was the priest king, a descendant or official representative of the lineage of Kukulkans, which stretched back to Moakan and perhaps Atlantis. The Mayan ruler was a dragon king, a unifier of heaven and earth, and an embodiment of the serpent power of spirit. To symbolically designate himself as the androgynous union of the twins, the priest king wore representations of Hunapu and Xbalenque, that's Hunapu, and Xbalenque, the mythical Mayan twins whose polar opposite principles he had merged within himself. Upon his head sat the colorful Quetzal feathers, symbolic of Hunapu, the spiritual twin, while covering his hands were the distinctive jaguar gloves of the Xbalenque, the jaguar and the martyrial twin. Let me clear my throat. And relight the stogie. Initiation into the order of the Kukulkans was administered within the temple pyramids and occurred during the solstices and equinoxes or other holiday determined by the Dzogchen, T-Z-O-L-K-I-N, or sacred calendar, as it was known. The candidates would be escorted between the monstrous dragons or gaping serpent's mouths, which flanked the entrance of the initiation temple. Upon arriving within the edifice's inner sanctums, they would be taken before an image of the world or cosmic tree, the road connecting heaven and earth, which would rise up above or in the back of the main altar. Then following the recitation of mantic chants and rites by the Kukulkan priests, the candidates enter Kutanilani, which is Mayan for Kundalini, would awaken. As it moved up the spine, the fire serpent would pierce the seven choklas, and that's Mayan for chakras, and that's spelled C-H-O-K-L-A-H-S. When it finally reached its destination at the top of the head, and I'm just going to say Kundalini, the Kundalini would merge into the crown chakra and fully awaken within the initiate the enlightened consciousness of the Kukulkans, or the plume serpents. This is similar to what happened to the Aryans in the East, the Near East and Egypt, who over time race-mixed with the dark races, leaving an identical situation of a mainly white upper caste in a culture, but with a mainly mixed and non-white populace as a whole. And he's got some Eastern links listed in this article here, and I will go through these as well. It says, worship. The archaeologists found many Hindu deities like Shiva, Shivalinga, Ganesh, Kali, Sun, Buddha, etc., in similar or slightly different forms, which were worshipped in ancient America. The Hindu god of luck, Ganesh, was worshipped in Central South America. Images of Ganesh have been excavated in plenty in Mexico. In other words, a lot of them were found. I didn't like the way you worded that. Had been excavated in plenty in Mexico. This god with the elephant's trunk is frequently depicted in Mexican manuscripts and in the temple ruins in Central America as the god with a proboscis, like that's proboscis, like horn. Hence, water is squirting, and his head is mostly frequently portrayed on the corners of the temple walls, which are always built with reference to the original points, and an image of Ekadant Ganesh was noticed in the temple by Copan, the great endologist, I think it's endologist, late Dr. D.S., I'm sorry, late Dr. W.S. Wankhekar. Okay, let me reread that. Okay, where was it at? I'm going to reread part of it. Whence water is squirting, and his head is most frequently portrayed on the corners of temple walls, which are always built with reference to the original points, and an image of Ekadant Ganesh was noticed in the temple by Kopan, the great Indologist, who late Dr. W.S. Wankhekar, and an image of a Hanuman, H-A-N-U-M-A-N, called by the name of Wilka Humana, H-U-E-M-A-N-A, and measuring 50 feet in height and 12 feet in breadth, was found in Guatemala. A similar one was found during an excavation of an Aztec temple in Mexico City. It was known as Uectal, E-U-H-E-C-T-A-L, which was a wind god or a monkey god. Both the Hindus and the Americans used similar items in their worship rituals. They both maintained the concept of the four yuga cycles, or cosmological seasons, extending over thousands of years, and conceived of 12 constellations with reference to the sun, as indicated by the Inca sun calendar. Royal insignias, systems of government, and practice of religious dance and temple worship all showed remarkable similarities, pointing strongly to the idea that the Americas were strongly influenced by the Aryans. The theory is found in the Vedic literature of India. The ancient Puranas, which literally mean histories, and the Mahabharata made mention of the Americas as lands rich with gold and silver. Argentina, which means related to silver, is thought to have been named after Arjuna, A-R-J-U-N-A, which means of silver hue, H-U-E. Hold on. Okay. Another scholar, Ramon Mena, author of Mexican Archaeology called the Nahuatl, N-A-H-U-A-T-L, Zapoteca, in the Mayan languages, being of Hindu origin. I got to cough again. Hold on. Okay. He went to say, a deep mystery enfolds the tribes that inhabited the state of Chiapas in the district named Palenque, their writing and the anthropological type, as well as their personal adornments, their system and style of construction, clearly indicate the remotest antiquity. They all speak of India and the Orient. Still another scholar, Ambassador Miles Poindexter, a former ambassador of the United States to Mexico, in his two-volume 1930s treatise, The Arya Incas, called the Mayan civilization unquestionably Hindu. He proposed that primitive Aryan words and people came to America by the island chains of Polynesia. The Mexican name for boat is a South Indian Tamil word, which is catamaran, C-A-T-A-M-A-R-A-N, and catamaran. And Poindexter gives a long list of words of the Quechua language, Q-U-I-C-H-U-A, languages and their analogous forms of Sanskrit. Similarities between the hymns of the Inca rulers of Peru and Vedic hymns have also been pointed out. A.L. Kroeber has also found striking similarities between the structures of Indo-European and the Penutian language of some of the tribes along the northwestern coast of California. Recently, an Indian scholar, B.C. Cahabra, in his Vestiges of Indian Culture in Hawaii, has noticed certain resemblances between the symbols found in the petroglyphs from the Hawaiian Islands and those on the Harappan seals. Some of the symbols in the petroglyphs are described as akin to early Brahmi script, B-R-A-H-M-I. Indeed, the parallels between the arts and culture of India and those of ancient America are too numerous and close to be attributed to an independent growth. A variant of art forms are common to Mexico, India, Java, and Indochina, the most striking of which are the Teocallis, T-E-O-C-A-L-L-I-S, the pyramids with receding stages faced with cut stone, with their stairways leading to a stone sanctuary on top. Many share surprisingly common features, such as the common Many share surprisingly common features such as serpent columns and banisters, vaulted galleries, corbelled arches, attached columns, stone cutout lattices, and Atlantean figures. These are typical of the Puuc style of Yucatan, P-U-U-C. Hein Geldern and Ekholm point out that the temple pyramids in Cambodia did not become important until the 9th and 10th centuries, a time coinciding with the beginning of the Puuc period, P-U-U-C. Vedic culture in Peru, Guru Vrata Das. In 1994, okay, I think he just placed this at the end, which is what I said at the first. Yeah. I'll read it again, though. In 1994, I saw a newspaper article that showed a photograph of a huaco, an ancient pot usually made of clay from the Inca culture or older. The sign that appeared on this huaco was a big swastika with four dots inside. This is a Vedic sign that you can see on the top of the gates of ancient temples. Of course, the archaeologists did not know what the symbol meant, and maybe they still don't know it. The earliest record of any human race in North America on record is that of the white race. Okay, that ends that article. I hope y'all enjoyed that. Now, the next one is Communism's Christian Roots. Christian theology is the grandmother of Bolshevism, quotes Oswald Spengler. Christianity and communism are very close spiritually and ideologically. This is a fairly well known concept that has been adopted by various thinkers, from Thomas More to Lev Tolstoy. Few people know that the world's first socialist state was established in Paraguay and was based on the ideas of Catholic Jesuits before Marx created his teachings. The Society of Jesus, the Jesuit religious order in the Catholic Church, was roughly equivalent to the KGB in the Soviet Union. These above quotes came from Pravda, which was the main Communist Party newspaper and leading newspaper of the former Soviet Union. And it came from an article called "Is There Any Difference Between Christianity and Communism?" And the date of the article was March 4th, 2013. And I believe Pravda is still in existence. Hold on, let me clear my throat. Now, there's a quote from Joseph Goebbels. American newspapers claim that Stalin had been preordained to save Christianity. Okay. Communism is not anti-Christian, as is commonly believed. In addition to this, the Catholic Church in China has over 70 million members and is growing. There is also the Catholic Changchun Cathedral in Communist North Korea. The nominal cathedral of the Roman Catholic Bishop of Pyongyang, North Korea. The Russian Orthodox Church worked hand-in-hand with the Communist Party in the USSR. The violence against its clergy during the revolution was simply to weed out the Tsarist elements from its ranks and nothing more. Stalin openly worked with the Orthodox Church to help the Communist war effort for the Red Army during the Second War. Today in Russia, high-ranking clergy in the Russian Orthodox Church openly advocate a Christian communist movement within their nation. The Catholic Church also has had a strong hand in the communistic liberation theology in South America. It's no mistake Catholic clergy could traverse the Iron Curtain during the Cold War with ease. And 80 million Bibles have been printed in China and counting, according to an article from Christianity Today, and it has a link, but I'm not going to it. Okay, Ernst Bloch, who lived from 1885 to 1977, was a German Marxist philosopher and atheist theologian. Although not a Christian himself, he is said to have bridged the gap between Christian communism and the Leninist branch of Marxism. One of Bloch's major works, The Principle of Hope, contains such declarations as Ubi Lenin Ibi Jerusalem, which means where Lenin is, there is Jerusalem. And the Bolshevist fulfillment of communism is part of the age-old fight for God. In truth, Christianity prepares the populace to be open to and to accept communism. There is nothing within the Christian doctrines or the teachings of the Nazarene that conflicts with communism in any way. Christianity is communism. Both programs work to enslave using terror, brutality, mass murder, and coercion. The Catholic Church was the KGB of the Middle Ages, ruling through terror, use of force, and mass murder. The Inquisition is a blatant example. Both programs prohibit the ownership of private property. Christianity prepares followers on a subliminal level for communism. Christians are indoctrinated to believe that poverty is a virtue. Once this concept takes hold upon one's subconscious mind, quite often a serious lack of money is a result, and this sometimes even lasts into future lives, speaking from a spiritual perspective. What this does is it also creates a self-perpetuating program and in turn creates generations of poor. The Christian churches then appear as helpers of the poor and benefactors when all along it was the Christian teachings that created and enforced the problem. The Jews created the problems and then gives the Jewish version of a damned solution for Gentiles. There's a link to another article here, but I'm not going to it, at least not tonight. There is nothing at all spiritual about Christianity. Christianity is a tool for removing spiritual knowledge and powers and replacing these with meaningless robotic prayers corrupted from and repeated in the same fashion as Far Eastern mantras and endless indoctrination with false teachings aimed to embed a fictitious status in history of the Jewish people in the minds of Christians, which is nothing spiritual at all. Few, if any, Christian preachers can even diagram the human soul, to use one example. The removal of and the corruption of spiritual knowledge prepares the populace to accept the atheistic communist state. Both Christianity and communism present themselves as brotherhood programs, promoting equality, prosperity, goodwill, and a better way of life. But upon closer examination of the real doctrines and histories, there is nothing more than a come along and beneath the surface, terror, mass murder, torture, forced indoctrination, and keeping the populace ignorant, which are the bulwark of both of these programs. Any fool who reads the Judeo-Christian Bible can plainly see the endless accounts of mass murder, pillaging, rape, enslavement, and threats of eternal torture and damnation if the doctrines are not taken seriously or adhered to, and above all, how Jehovah was a murderous monster who preyed upon Gentiles, no different from the communist programs. And there's a quote here from Luke 19:27. But those mine enemies, which would not that I should reign over them, bring hither and slay them before me. That's a direct quote from Jesus, basically advocating murder. Okay, rebellion is a definite no-no and is of the devil. Christianity also prepares followers for communism in that one is indoctrinated to endure injustice. Nearly everyone has heard the biblical scriptures about turning the other cheek, walking the extra mile, loving one's enemies, and so forth. These teachings work together with communism in destroying the justice system and personal rights. Crime is allowed to get so out of control, and just take a look around you, that the populace is not only discouraged from fighting back, but if one should defend oneself, one is often punished for this. What these Jewish programs do is they set a trap. Most people eventually are more than willing to give up their rights in favor of ultra-strict laws in order to control crime. Both programs prohibit taking any personal action in the way of enforcing justice and place this responsibility in the hands of the state for communism and in the hands of that so-called God for Christianity. Any rebellion or fighting back or getting even is a grave offense. The acceptance of abuse and injustice are both very necessary for establishing a slave state. A slave must never try to fight back or rebel in any way. Hate is another taboo in both programs. Let me clear my throat. A look into communism's birth. Communism was created out of the organization called the League of the Just. The motto of the League of the Just was Bund der Gerechten, or Bund der Gerechtigkeit. How did this get a German name? Gerechtigkeit. Was all men are brothers, and its goals were the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth based on the ideas of love of one's neighbor, equality, and justice. At a congress held in London in June 1847, the League of the Just merged with members of the Communist Corresponding Committee headed by Karl Marx and Frederick Engels, adopting a new organizational character and program and reconstituting itself as the Communist League. This is the basis of the Christian doctrine. We can trace communism's roots back to the radical liberal ideology in Europe, which itself is Christianity in disguise, as Nietzsche stated about the French Revolution and its liberal ideology as the daughter and continuation of Christianity. This radical universalist egalitarian doctrine is at the heart of Christianity and liberalism, with its stepping off point into communism, where liberalism then morphed into communism openly. During the decade of the 1840s, the word communist came into general use to describe those who held the left wing of the Jacobin Party of the French Revolution as their ideological forefathers. This political tendency saw itself as egalitarian heritors of the 1795 Conspiracy of Equals headed by Gracchus Babeuf, B-A-B-E-U-F, the sans-culottes of Paris, which had decades earlier been the base of support for Babeuf, artisans, journeymen, and the urban unemployed, was seen as a potential foundation for a new social system based upon the modern machine production of the day. The French thinker Etienne Cabot inspired the imagination with a novel about a utopian society based upon communal machine production called Voyage in Icarie, I-C-A-R-I-E, written in 1839. The revolutionary Louis Auguste Blanqui argued in favor of an elite organizing the overwhelming majority of the population against the rich, seizing the government in a coup d'etat and instituting a new egalitarian economic order. A review of the emerging trends from Christianity to liberalism and into communism. Okay, liberalism is Christianity without the Christ. And William Gailey Simpson's Which Way, Western Man. Revelo Oliver, quote, "The other apostates I have mentioned, and many that are now forgotten, together with almost all of the anti-Christians of recent centuries, exemplify the operation of what may be called the law of cultural residues. In all civilized societies, when a long-established and generally accepted belief is found to be incredible, good minds abandon it, but they commonly retain derivative beliefs that were originally deduced from the creed they have rejected and logically must depend on it. Thus, it happened that modern enemies of Christianity rejected the mythology, but uncritically retained faith in the social and ethical superstitions derived from it, a faith which they oddly call rational, but hold with a religious fervor." He goes on to say, "They laugh at the silly story about Adam and his spare rib, but they continue to believe in a human race descended from a single pair of ancestors, and hence in a brotherhood of man. They speak of all mankind, giving to the term as unctuous and mystic meaning, with which they do not invest corresponding terms, such as all marsupials or all ungulates. They prate about the rights of man, although a moment's thought should suffice to show that, in the absence of a decree from a supernatural monarch, there can be no rights other than those which the citizens of a stable and homogeneous society have, by covenant or established custom, bestowed on themselves, and that while the citizens may show kindness to aliens, slaves, and dogs, such beings obviously can have no rights." He goes on to say, "They do not believe that one-third of a god became incarnate in the most squalid region on earth to associate with illiterate peasants, harangue the rabble of a barbarian race, and magically exalt the ignorant and uncouth to make folly of the wisdom of this world, so that the last shall be first. That they do not believe, but they cling to the morbid hatred of the superiority that makes Christians dote on whatever is lowly, inferior, irrational, debased, deformed, and degenerate." And again, he says, "They gabble about the sanctity of human life, especially the vilest forms of it, without reflecting that it takes a God creator to make something sacred, and they frantically agitate for a universal equality that can be attained only by reducing all human beings to the level of the lowest, evidently unaware that they are merely echoing the Christians' oft-expressed yearning to become sheep, which are the most stupid of all mammals, herded by a good shepherd, which is implicit in all the tales of the New Testament, although most bluntly expressed in another gospel, which reports Jesus as promising that, after he has tortured and butchered the more civilized populations of the earth, there will be a resurrection, and his ovine pets will pop out of their graves, all of the same age, all of the same sex, all of the same stature, and all having indistinguishable features, so that they will be as identical as the bees in a swarm." Two more paragraphs. "Although the liberal and Marxist cults have doctrinal differences as great as those that separate Lutherans from Baptists, they are basically the same superstition. And whether or not we should call them religions depends on whether we restrict the word to belief in supernatural persons or extend it to include all forms of blind faith based on emotional excitement instead of observed facts and reason. When those atheistic cults scream out of their out their hatred of fascists and Nazis, they obviously must believe that those wicked persons are possessed of the devil and should therefore be converted or exterminated to promote holiness and love. And when they see racists who impiously substitute fact and reason for unthinking faith and approved fairy tales, their lust to extirpate evil is as great as that of the Christian mob that dragged the fair and too intelligent Hypatia from her carriage and lovingly used oyster shells to scrape the flesh from her bones while she was still alive. With very few exceptions, the anti-Christians, no doubt unwittingly, retained in their minds a large part of Christian doctrine, and they even revived the most poisonous elements of the primitive Bolshevism of antiquity, which had been intuinated or held in abeyance by the established churches in the great days of Christendom. And today, professed atheists do not think it odd that on all social questions they are in substantial agreement with the howling dervishes and evangelical shamans who, subsidized with lavish publicity by the organized jury who control the boob tubes and other means of communication, greedily participate in the current drive to reduce Americans to total imbecility with every kind of irrational hoax. And a quote from Oswald Spengler here: Christian theology is the grandmother of Bolshevism. And there's a few more paragraphs in the article itself. Let me cough. The Latin American branch of Christian communist liberation theology, according to theologians such as Leonardo Boff, is rooted in the concept that prudence is the understanding of situations of radical crisis. Among Christian communists, historical materialism is utilized as a methodology of analysis to define the nature of the crisis in question as a product of political, economic dynamics and modalities derived from the workings of what is termed the late capital / imperialist mode of production. According to this subset of liberation theology, the challenge for the Christian communist is then to define what it means in context of a concrete analysis of the concrete social reality to affirm a preferential option for the poor and oppressed as praxis, meaning active theory, and as commanded by an ethics allegedly rooted in the Beatific teachings of Jesus, or Beatific, B-E-A-T-I-D-I-C. Christian communist liberation theology is not about evangelizing per se, but rather about developing an orthopraxis, meaning ethical action, or the condition of coming to the light by doing the works of God, that aims to reconcile the Beatific ethics of Jesus as espoused in the Sermon on the Mount with existing social struggles against what is termed neocolonialism or late capitalism. Both Christian communism and liberation theology stress orthopraxis over orthodoxy. A narrative of the nature of contemporary social struggles is developed via materialist analysis utilizing historiographic concepts developed by Karl Marx. A concrete example are the Paraguayan Sin Tierra, or landless movement, who encourage indirect land seizures and the establishment of socialized agricultural cooperative production in asentamientos. The contemporary Paraguayan Sin Tierra operate in a very similar manner as that of the Reformation era diggers. For Camilo Torres, the founder of the Colombian guerrilla group ELN, developing his orthopraxic meant celebrating the Catholic Eucharist only among those in armed struggle against the army of the Colombian state while fighting alongside them. Christian communists hold the biblical verses in Acts 2 and 4 as evidence that the first Christians lived in a communist society. Thomas Wharton Collins preaching is a good description of biblical sources being used with the goal of a common proper society. Professor Jose P. Miranda, Comunismo en la Biblia, 1981, translated as Communism in the Bible. But in addition, they also cite numerous other biblical passages which, in their view, support the idea that communism is the most ethical social system and that it is inescapably constitutive of the kingdom of God on earth. The most often quoted of these biblical citations are taken from the three synoptic gospels, which describe the life and ministry of Jesus. One of Jesus' most famous remarks regarding the wealthy can be found in Matthew 19, 16 through 24. The same event is also described in Mark 10, 17 through 25, and Luke 18, 18 through 25. And the metaphor of a camel going through the eye of a needle is common to both Matthew and Luke. And Jesus said unto him, If thou wilt be perfect, go and sell that thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me. But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Then said Jesus unto his disciples, Verily I say unto you, that a rich man shall hardly enter into the kingdom of heaven. And again I say unto you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. Jesus also described money changers, in other words, those engaged in money and currency exchange, as thieves and chased them out of the temple in Jerusalem. This is described in Matthew 21, 12 through 14, Mark 11, 15, and John 2, 14 through 16. In addition, communistic attitudes and implications can be found in Leviticus 25, 35 through 38. Most significantly, this is part of the law of Moses, and as such, is commandment rather than exhortation or airing of opinion. This fact bears heavily upon the subsequent discussion of the question of compulsory or voluntary relinquishing of riches, either as a possible entry requirement to Christian grace, or as a means of achieving divine intentions for human social order. Again, to quote Oswald Spengler, Christianity is the grandmother of Bolshevism. Okay, I'm going to stop for just a second here. And I'm going to go back to the studio and I'm going to play a song while I give my voice and my eyes a little bit of a break here. I will be right back. Okay. I just took a look at the next article, Adolf Hitler and the Man of Peace, and I knew it was a little bit on the long side, but it's actually pretty long. It's been a while since I read that, and I did not quite realize how long it was. And so I can guarantee you the other articles will not be gotten to, and more than likely, I think it may continue into another show. However, what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to read a large chunk of it, and I'll go into the archives for a little while, maybe 15, 20 minutes, maybe half an hour, we'll see, but no longer than half an hour. And so what I would suggest, since you can't hear anything after 2 hours, you know, shortly before the top of the hour, if you want to stay on and hear, call in. Okay. Again, I'm not taking any calls this show, but if you want to hear, just call in and listen. But that's one way to do it. So anyway, let me go ahead and get on to this article here. This is called Adolf Hitler, Man of Peace. And here's a quote from Adolf. "This war thrust us years back into our constructive work. It is deplorable. I have not indeed become the Chancellor of the Greater German Reich in order to conduct war." That was in 1940. If Hitler was the monster the Jews lie and say he was, he might have won the war. Hitler showed mercy on the entire British army at Dunkirk and personally ordered his generals to stop the attack and allow the English to leave. Hitler spared his enemies when he could have killed them all. Previous and still, Hitler had worked around the clock to obtain peace with England. Many Gentiles in England, including members of the royal family and even the famed T.E. Lawrence of Arabia himself, was a pro-Nazi. Lawrence was murdered on his way to an all-important meeting to help bring a peace treaty with Germany before the war. Rudolf Hess also made a fateful mission to Britain in 1941 to meet with pro-peace members of the English nobility and government and bring peace between the two nations, where he was captured by the Kosher Churchill's secret police and spent the rest of his life in a solitary prison cell. Hess was a prominent figure in Nazi Germany, acting as Adolf Hitler's deputy in the Nazi Party. On the eve of war with the Soviet Union, he fled to Scotland in an attempt to negotiate peace, but was arrested. He was tried at Nuremberg and sentenced to life in prison, where he died, or probably murdered, in 1987. He said, "My coming to England in this way is, I realize, so unusual that nobody will easily understand it. I was confronted by a hard decision. I do not think I could have arrived at my final choice unless I had continually kept before my eyes the vision of an endless line of children's coffin with weeping mothers behind them, both English and German, and another line of coffins of mothers with mourning children." And that was a statement by Rudolf Hess on June 10th, 1941. Let me clear my throat. He also said, "I was suspicious for several reasons. After all," this is a quote from someone else, "I was suspicious for several reasons. After all, Hess, who had been held in Spandau for almost 30 years, was by then 93 years old and fragile. I doubted he had the strength to kill himself with a cord, which was not attached at both ends to anything." And that was a quote by Lieutenant Colonel Eugene K. Byrd on the death of Hess to a Deutsche Press Agentur reporter, as quoted in former governor of Spandau prison. In the article, "Former governor of Spandau prison dies in Berlin." Hess was murdered by the Jews to tie up loose ends and remove anyone who might still be alive to tell the truth. And, of course, the Holocaust hoax is a lie. Even a Jew admits and proves the Holocaust is a lie. Hitler also forbade the use of chemical weapons and did not allow the creation of nuclear weapons, as he was disgusted, aghast at such a thing. Hitler was a combat soldier at the front and highly decorated for bravery for the entire Great War, and knew firsthand what such Jewish created weapons were like. And it says here the creator of gas weapons was a Jewish chemist, and I've read that before. He, like millions of men, experienced being wounded by such weapons. The creators of atomic weapons and war was a Jew named Oppenheimer, and his fellow Jews were behind getting it built and used. Japan was already going to surrender to the Allies, so there was no need to use atomic weapons on them. It was Talmudic hatred for Gentiles, nothing more. It was Jewish-dominated politicking in America that had forced Japan into war on purpose in the first place by placing embargoes on Japan that would have left Japan impoverished and starving. The Jews committed a real Holocaust on Japan because they wanted to test their new atomic weapons on a real Goyim population. The real reason America came into the war was, by that time, the Jewish elite were in control of its vital networks, and so did everything to push America into the war. Under crypto-Jew Roosevelt, who was of Dutch Jewish ancestry, and his staff, which reads like a synagogue list, and by the way, I think I will send a JPEG out, showing that in the form of a Star of David, a list of his staff this week. So if you're on my list, you'll get one. And if you're not and you want it, subscribe. Roosevelt, in a telegram to the French Premier Renault on June 15th, 1940, promised to double American aid to France on the condition it continued the war with Germany. In December 19, 1939, an American warship, the Tuscaloosa, maneuvered a German passenger vessel, the Columbus, into the hands of the British Navy while in the security zone, of which was scuttled by the Germans. In January 1940, the American warship Tretton, T-R-E-T-O-N, in violation of international law, reported the movements of the German merchant ships Arauca, La Plata, and Wagoi to enemy Navy vessels. On June 27, 1940, Roosevelt announced a limitation on the free movement of foreign merchant or Axis vessels in American ports, which is also in violation of internal law. In November of the same year, Roosevelt allows for American warships to chase the German merchant ships, the Phrygia, Idarwald, and Rhine, which ended up in all three ships scuttling themselves to avoid capture. This and its identical acts are all acts of provoked war against Germany, helping enemy nations to attack their ships and citizens. And I'm going to interject something here. And one of the first things the United States did was to invade Iceland, and it basically just occupied it. There was nothing to fight, of course. But the American ships did attack German submarines, and thus it was clearly admitted even by Western historians that Americans fired the first shots against the Germans. And Hitler was pressured, I think it was by Admiral, was it Dönitz? I'm not sure, to declare war on the United States for a good while before he actually did. Anyway, let me light this cigarette real quick. Okay, Roosevelt also sent the OSS Chief Colonel Donovan to start uprisings against Germany and Italy in Sofia and Belgrade. Roosevelt then permitted American citizens to join the RAF while also openly transferring RAF personnel in America, openly training RAF personnel in America. In September of 1940, Roosevelt transferred 50 American destroyers to the British Navy. In March 1941, Roosevelt imposed the Lend-Lease Act on America, which meant, as president, he could officially furnish as much aid as he wanted to at the taxpayers' expense that he felt was in America's interest to defend, such as the Soviet Union. This aid was the major reason the Red Beast was able to survive in the early part of the Eastern War. And by the way, while our men in the South Pacific were allowed to be captured by Japanese, we diverted supplies and materials to the Soviet Union. Roosevelt had also worked to block other nations from making peace or having any peaceful relations with Germany, using economic policy as a weapon against them. In 1940, he froze all Norwegian and Danish assets. Despite the fact Germany had not nor had the plan to loot or dictate financial policy to either nation, later Belgian assets in America were also frozen. Frozen basically equals stolen. With Roosevelt recognizing nonsense panels of exiles from such nations as governments in exile, an act of blatant hostility toward Axis Europe. Roosevelt's actions from even before the war showed he committed to warfare on any level against the National Socialist nation in Europe. On April 13, 1941, American ships were permitted to pass freely through the Red Sea to supply British armies fighting in the Middle East. In March of the same year, the Americans started to openly confiscate all German ships they could, while retreating German citizens, once again in violation, of international law, like prisoners. In another indictment, two German officers that escaped from Canadian custody and fled to America were in violation of internal law, returned chained back into Canada, which was at war with Germany. At the same time, American naval ships started to increase patrols in the Western Atlantic, reporting to the British Navy on any observations on Axis ships, military or civilian, while repairing British naval ships in U.S. ports. Again, this is the guy who doesn't use commas. In May, Norwegian vessels working for the British were openly armed and repaired in American ports in violation of international law. In June, American troops arrived in Greenland to start building military air bases. Then on the 9th of the same month was a report from the British that Roosevelt had ordered an American warship to openly attack a German submarine off Greenland. Then German assets in violation of international law in the same month, America were officially frozen. Around the same time, Roosevelt orders the recalls of the German consuls and calls for the closing of the German press agency called Transocean, the German Library of Information in New York, as well as the German National Rail Office called the Reichsbahn. In July of 1941, American armed forces under Roosevelt ordered Greenland occupied. Okay, I'm going to have to just improvise every once in a while when I read this. In July of 1941, American armed forces under Roosevelt issued orders to occupy Greenland, which is an area of German military operations, in a hope to force Germany into a war with America in an attempt to influence the outcome of German U-boat operations against Germans' favor. As part of this, on July 10, 1941, American Naval Secretary Frank Knox orders that all American warships are officially ordered to fire on all Axis vessels. This is another announcement of open war on Germany by the American government. On September of that year, the U.S. warship Greer, G-R-E-E-R, joins with British warships to attack German submarines in the Atlantic. soon after a German submarine identifies an American warship acting as an active military escort for British convoys. I need to clear my throat. Roosevelt openly admits in a speech given on September 11, 1941, he had personally given the order for American warships to fire on all Axis vessels and repeatedly given the order. On the 29th of the same month, American warship patrols attacked a German submarine off Greenland. On October 17th, the American warship Kearney acted on this order and attacked another German submarine. Then in November of the same year, American warships, in violation of international law, captured the German ship Odenwald, take it to port, an American port, took it to an American port, and imprisoned the crew. The American government and its Jewish controllers had already declared war on Germany privately for years. The same methods were used against Japan to force them into a war as well. It's no secret anymore that the U.S. government knew about Pearl Harbor months in advance and did nothing, as they wanted an official reason to do what they had been doing all along. The only thing that I can say they actually did was they moved all the carriers out to the out to sea and left only the battleships in port, as they knew that the war would essentially mainly be a war with aircraft carriers, and the battleship was becoming antiquated. However, we still did use battleships in World War II. The USS Texas, which, by the way, does still exist, was used in World War I and World War II, and it is anchored in port here near the Houston Ship Channel. It's the only battleship to have served in both World Wars. Luckily, they didn't scrap it, and it has been refurbished. They had to. This is too old. Poland and more Jewish hate. The same Jew placed international embargoes on Germany during the 1930s. See, Judea declares war on Germany. That's a headline we have all seen. And Benjamin Friedman, Confessions, says, would have left one-third of the German people in starvation. Even then, Germany did not go to war until Hitler had no choice but to invade Poland to stop the genocide of the ethnic German populace, which had killed around 20,000 to 50,000 innocent people by Jewish-created and backed Haitian-style murder squads, and that was after Hitler had warned Poland to stop it and appealed to the League of Nations, the UN of the day, to do something. The Brunnberg massacre was the final straw. Thousands of Germans were massacred, literally Rwandan style. Hitler's invasion of Poland was done to end the genocide of thousands of innocent people by force, as appeals to reason and compassion had failed. Churchill, the Jew puppet, and whose mother was a Jewess, as even reported by the Jerusalem Post, and from 1936, was being funded by a group of mainly Jewish bankers, former politicians, and industrialists called the Focus Group, and was given a huge amount of money by the Jewish chairman of the Shell Company in July of that year. And that's Shell, S-H-E-L-L, that's capital S. Now, I believe he means probably Shell Oil. Okay, he doesn't say that, but I'm presuming that's what he meant. He made a deal with the Pole government behind the door. They were to force Germany into attacking by any means, and then England and France could declare war and look like the morally righteous side. This was to open a two-front war between Poland in the east and in France and England in the west, which was to defeat Germany, as the Polish army alone outnumbered the German one. Key areas of Polish society had no doubt been subverted by Jewry as well by this point. Lord Nathan Rothschild was the most powerful man in Britain, quotes British Prime Minister Lloyd George. My cigarette out went out. Hold on. The British Empire had been under Jewish control for a century by this point, with the Jewish banking dynasties. Many such Jews had also become part of the British nobility, such as the Rothschilds. And this is a quote here. The Rothschild family, the British branch of the family, was elevated into British nobility at the request of Queen Victoria. It has been argued that during the 19th century, the family possessed by far the largest private fortune in the world, and by far the largest fortune in modern world history. Even having the Jews in control of the British government directly, such as Disraeli, Benjamin Disraeli, 1st Earl of Beaconsfield, KG, PC, FRS, okay, September 21st, 1804, circa 9, okay, hold on, let me get this straight here. Okay, such as Disraeli. Benjamin Disraeli, 1st Earl of Beaconsfield, was a British Prime Minister from 1804 to 1881, a parliamentarian, conservative statesman, and literary figure. He started from comparatively humble origins. He served in government for 3 decades, twice as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Although his father had him baptized to Anglicanism at age 12, he was nonetheless Britain's first and thus far only prime minister who was born into a Jewish family originally from Italy. And before him, by the way, you could not be in the British government unless you were a Christian. And so they did some maneuvering to get this pulled off, and I won't go into any of that. Maybe perhaps one day, another time. They did not count on the fact that Hitler was a genius who had created a modern people's army and lightning war tactics, which, if you study the history of military thinking, were revolutionary and so far ahead of the time. Hence, while Poland and then France fell in 2 weeks each, even after what the wicked Jews had done to Germans in Europe, Hitler still asked for and gave fair terms and friendship, and not as a conqueror. France agreed with the Vichy nationalist government, but England refused. Poland stayed under occupation considering what had happened, and Poland had already invaded Germany several times before in the Weimar period, but they were treated with respect under Hitler's direct orders. There was no revenge actions taken up towards the Polish populace for Brandenburg. The Soviet Union, which had attacked from the east, taking advantage of the situation for a power grab, did, however, commit genocide on the Polish population, the most famous example being the Katyn Massacre. The Katyn Massacre, also known as the Katyn Forest Massacre, was a mass execution of Polish nationals carried out by the Soviet secret police, the NKVD, in April and May of 1940. It was based on Lavrenty Beria's proposal to execute all members of the Polish officer corps, which was dated March 5, 1940. This official document was then approved and signed by the Soviet Politburo, including its leader, Joseph Stalin. The number of victims is estimated at around 22,000, the most commonly cited number being 21,768. The victims were murdered in the Katyn Forest in Russia, the Kalinin and Kharkov prisons, and elsewhere. Around 8,000 were officers taken prison during the 1939 Soviet invasion of Poland, the rest being Polish doctors, professionals, lawmakers, police officers, and other public servants arrested for being intelligence agents and gendarmes, G-E-N-D-A-R-M-E-S, landowners, saboteurs, factory owners, lawyers, officials, and priests, since Poland's conscription service required every unexempted university graduate to become a reserve officer, the NKVD was able to round up much of the Polish intelligentsia. And, of course, as we know, they always cut off the head of wherever they go and replace it with theirs. And they always kill the most intelligent population of the population. I believe the Khmer Rouge even killed anyone who wore glasses, as if you had glasses, you had a need to read. Otherwise, what else would you need glasses for? The Battle of Britain, and by the way, we're fixing to go into archives in just a couple of minutes here. The Battle of Britain started in defense against Kosher Churchill sending bombers across the channel to bomb German cities and towns first. Hitler warned him to stop such actions. Churchill refused, and after several more times, then Hitler sent the German Air Force across the channel, and then only to bomb the British Air Force's bases to cripple Kosher Churchill in harass RAF terror bombers from attacking any more German civilian centers. Call in if you're going to listen in. What happened is during a night attack, one of the German bombers, thinking they were over the channel, had to drop their excess bombs to have the fuel left to make it home. Sadly, they were over a British city, but since the blackouts were in effect, they had no way of knowing. They worked to avoid any civilian casualty, to the point under 21,000 for the entire battle. Even when they were in the position, they could have leveled half of England. And this was only after Hitler had bent over backwards trying to make peace with England from the 1930s and on, as mentioned, even sparing the entire army at Dunkirk. Clear my throat. The hidden part of the air war Talmudic protocols in action says February 13, 14, 1945, Holocaust over Dresden, known as the Florence of the North. Dresden was a hospital city for wounded soldiers. Not one military unit, not one anti-aircraft battery was deployed in the city. Together with 600,000 refugees from Breslau, Dresden was filled with nearly 1.2 million people. Churchill had asked for suggestions how to blaze 600,000 refugees. He wasn't interested how to target military installations 60 miles outside of Dresden. More than 700,000 phosphorus bombs were dropped on 1.2 million people, one bomb for every two people. The temperature in the center of the city reached 16,000 centigrade. More than 260,000 bodies and residues of bodies were counted. But those who perished in the center of the city can't be traced. Approximately 500,000 children, women, the elderly, wounded soldiers, and the animals of the zoo were slaughtered in one night. In fact, little had been done to provide the ancient city of artists and craftsmen with anti-aircraft defenses. One squadron of planes had been stationed in Dresden for a while, but the Luftwaffe decided to move the aircraft to another area where they would be of use. A gentleman's agreement seemed to prevail, designating Dresden as an open city. An easy opportunity to mass murder as many innocent people as possible by jury. 100,000 people died in the first 20 minutes of the attack. One eyewitness who survived told of seeing young men carrying babies running up and down the streets, their dresses and hair on fire, screaming until they fell down or collapsed. Buildings fell on top of them. As the German government stated after the attack, Dresden had no war industries. It was a place of culture and clinics. What distinguished this raid was the cold-blooded ruthlessness with which it was carried out. U.S. Mustangs appeared low over the city, strafing anything that moved, including a column of rescue vehicles rushing to the city to evacuate survivors. One assault was aimed at the banks of the Elbe River, where refugees had huddled during the horrible night. Dresden citizens barely had time to reach their shelters. The first bomb fell at 10:09 p.m. The attack lasted 24 minutes, leaving the inner city a raging sea of fire. Precision saturation bombing had created the desired firestorm. There was a 3-hour pause between the first and second raids. the lull had been calculated to lure civilians from their shelters into the open again. To escape the flames, tens of thousands of civilians had crowded into the Grocer Garden, a magnificent park nearly 1.5 miles square. The second raid came at 1:22 a.m. with no warning. Twice as many bombers returned with a massive load of incendiary bombs. The second wave was designed to spread the raging firestorm into the Grocer Garden. It was a complete success. Within a few minutes, a sheet of flames ripped across the grass, uprooting trees and littering the branches of others with everything from bicycles to human limbs. For days afterwards, they remained bizarrely strewn about as grim reminders of Allied sadism. At the start of the second air assault, many were still huddled in tunnels and cellars, waiting for the fires of the first attack to die down. At 1:30 a.m., an ominous rumble reached the ears of the commander of a labor service convoy sent into the city on a rescue mission. He described it this way. The detonation shook the cellar walls. The sound of the explosions mingled with a new, stranger sound, which seemed to come closer and closer, the sound of a thundering waterfall. It was the sound of the mighty tornado howling in the inner city. Others hiding below ground died, but they died painlessly. They simply glowed bright orange and blue in the darkness. As the heat intensified, they either disintegrated into cinders or melted into a thick liquid, often 3 or 4 feet deep in spots. Shortly after 10:30 on the morning of February 14th, the last raid swept over the city. American bombers pounded the rubble that had been Dresden for a steady 38 minutes, but this attack was not nearly as heavy as the first two. In the last year of the war, Dresden had become a hospital town. During the previous night's massacre, heroic nurses had dragged thousands of crippled patients to the Elbe. The low-flying Mustangs and machine gunned those helpless patients, as well as thousands of old men, women, and children who had escaped the city. When the last plane left the sky, Dresden was a scorched ruin, its blackened streets filled with corpses. The city was spared no horror. A flock of vultures escaped from the zoo and fattened on the carnage. Rats swarmed over the piles of corpses. A Swiss citizen described his visit to Dresden 2 weeks after the raid. I could see torn off arms and legs, mutilated torsos and heads, which had been wrenched from their bodies and rolled away. In places, the corpses were still lying so densely that I had to clear a path through them in order not to tread on arms and legs. Kurt Vonnegut was an American POW being held in Dresden when it was bombed in 1945 and wrote a famous anti-war novel called Slaughterhouse 5, named after the area he took refuge in to survive the bombing of the city. He stated after the attack, the city looked like the surface of the moon. In December 1944, Vonnegut was captured by the German army and became a prisoner of war. In Slaughterhouse 5, he describes how he narrowly escapes death a few months later in the firebombing of Dresden. "Yes, by your people, the English," meaning the English, "may I say," he insists, "you guys burnt the place down, turned it into a single column of flame. More people died there in the firestorm, in that one big flame, than died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. I'm fond of your people on occasion, but I was just thinking about Bomber Harris, who believed in attacks on civilian populations to make them give up. A hell of a lot of Royal Air Force guys were ashamed of what Harris had made them do, and that's really sportsmanship, and that's really sportsmanship, and of course, the Brits are famous for being good sports." As one RAF member who took part in the attack stated after, "I found myself making comments to the crew, 'Oh God, those poor people.' It was," excuse me, "it was completely uncalled for. You can't justify it." Here is an example of a minor RAF raid. During the latter stages of World War II, Pforzheim, a town in southwestern Germany, was bombed a number of times. The largest raid in one of the most devastating area bombardments of the war was carried out by the Royal Air Force on the evening of February 23, 1945. As many as 17,600 people, or 31.4% of the town's population, were killed in the air raid. About 83% of the town's buildings were destroyed. Two-thirds of the complete area of Pforzheim, and between 80 and 100% of the inner city. The RAF bomber, or Ariel Genocide Force, took some of the highest death rates of any service in the war for Britain, because the Germans fought so desperately against the terror bombing strikes on their people. German fighter pilots would crash their burning shot apart fighters along with themselves into RAF bombers just to stop one more of them from being able to murder any more of their people. It was that horrific of a situation. The situation in the East, Jewish aggression on display. Okay, it's almost 10 after the hour. I'll read another 10 or 15 minutes here or so. Hitler knew that fighting a defensive war against the Red Army was suicide, as they would be facing up to 30 million troops, thousands of tanks, planes, and heavy guns. If the Red Army was not struck while still mobilizing for their invasion, Western Europe was doomed. Jewry was playing their big red hand as they were the Soviet Union. Even Stalin was a Yid. His real name, Dazugashvili, in Georgian means son of a Jew. The Eastern struggle, Jewish aggression on display. The invasion of the Soviet Union was done after German intelligence informed them with the overwhelming evidence that the Soviet Union was planning to attack them in the spring of 1941, and yes, the entire Red Army was mobilizing on the borders. It was too big to be exercise alone. It was an invasion force. Operation Sea Lion, the invasion of England, was nothing more than a ruse to distract the Soviets from the fact that they knew and were preparing a first survival strike. Let me clear my throat and light another cigarette. German Chief of Staff Franz Hadler stated that Russia was preparing for an attack on Germany. We know today from good sources that he, referring to Hitler, was right about that. At Nuremberg, General Winter testified under oath. We had at the time the subjective impression that we were striking into an offensive deployment in progress. Senior General Jodl is on record stating that Hitler never even mentioned the idea of Lebensraum in 1940, when the discussion on a preemptive war with the Soviet Union came up. This is an open statement to the damning fact of how much the Jewish lie machine was working to rewrite history. The war was defensive, not ideological on their part. As stated by Senior General Jodl, who testified at Nuremberg, the Führer has never named in my presence even just one hint of a reason other than the purely strategic. Hitler, by Jodl testimony, made the following statements to him many times over. There is no doubt now that England puts her hopes in this last mainland proxy. Otherwise, she would have already called off the war after Dunkirk. Agreements have certainly already been made. The Russian deployment is unmistakable. One day, suddenly, we shall be either coldly blackmailed or attacked. Churchill in 1940 purposely rejected Germany's offer of peace and voted to keep the war going because as he stated, were Sir Stratford Cripps meeting with the Soviets in Moscow, they had been given the direct promise the Soviet Union was going to come into the war on Britain's side. So the Eastern War started because the Jews started it. The Axis army was welcomed as a liberator across the Eastern nations. They went through as they had freed the Gentiles from Jewish rule under communism, which had already murdered over 20 million innocent Gentiles. 7 million died in the Ukrainian Holocaust alone, which was overseen by the Jew Lazar Moiseyevich Kaganovich on orders from the Jew Stalin. Millions more died in a system of death camps called gulags, each run by a Jewish commissar. The Jews just worked them to death on purpose, as shooting them was too quick. On the camps from survivors, if you complain or write anything, heaven forbid, they will frame you for an attempted escape or for something else, and they will shoot you like a dog. They, referring to the Jews, lined us up naked and barefoot at 22 degrees below zero and keep us outside for up to an hour. It is difficult to describe all the chaos and terror that is going on in Solovki and the other sections of the concentration camps. They forced inmates to eat their own feces. Tens of millions of innocent Gentiles died in these Jewish-run camps. The Jew, being the master of projection, lied and took what they did to the Gentiles in the gulags and claimed it was what the Germans did to them. In fact, reading the reports and letters of the Axis soldiers of the first waves going into the first former communist-controlled areas, it was the citizens themselves who were rounding up and punishing the Jews in general, as they all knew the commissars were local Jews, and even anti-Semitism was literally the death penalty under the Reds. The kosher NKVD, before running away, had rounded up any Gentile they could and brutally murdered them in droves with everything from axes to bullets in pure Talmudic vial. When the family members found the bodies stacked like wood in the courtyards, and as mentioned, they knew it was the Jews, they took revenge. It was the Axis troops that ended the pogroms, not started them. Unlike the kosher claims, and yes, all commissars given the distinguishing crimes against humanity, the Axis troops had found they were committing, were ordered to be shot on sight. Okay, that made sense. For a second there, I didn't think that made sense. Perhaps I didn't read it in that manner where it did make sense. Let me cough here for a sec. The so-called partisans in the East, as in the West, were actually all Jews, especially at the start. The Western branch of the resistance, referring to the Red Terror movements like the famed French Resistance, were almost to a person Jews. Hence why the Axis had to round up and imprison every Jew they could find, as they knew the Jews were working against them as a terrorist racial collective behind the lines and at the front. Axis Europe was fighting for its life at this point. With the opening of the KGB archives, it was found that the Russian populations living in the Axis-liberated territories worked in full cooperation with the Germans against the Red Beast. These people had lived fully under the Red Heel and had lost many loved ones to it. Contrary to popular belief, there never was a Russian Revolution, but the White Russians, the nationalists, fighting desperately against an international Jewish takeover, of whom the Red Armies were mainly armed with Jews from the Pale and abroad, and tens of thousands of Chinese mercenaries bought and shipped in from the east by the Jews in general dregs. Okay, a couple more paragraphs. The Germans worked with the Russian communities and other Eastern Europeans and built them hospitals, new farms, homes, community centers, and schools. They liberated numerous gulags and freed the prisoners, helped restore them to health, and returned them to their homes and families, and built a real spirit of friendship with them. In places like Ukraine, as in Russia, they worked with the locals to help uncover mass graves of thousands of murdered innocents by the Jewish NKVD, helping to identify as many as possible and return them to their families for proper burials. When investigating the crimes and bringing about still in the other area responsible to justice, as it turns out, 99.9% of those brought to justice all happened to be Jews. No surprise there. It was also found during the investigation the killings of the populace by the Jewish-led Reds were selective targeting of the best and brightest elements of the Gentile community. Upon after their murders, any property they did not have was given to the local Jewish populations right out of the Talmud. The property they did have, I don't know if I said that right. Upon after the murders, any property they did have was given to the local Jewish populations. The Germans helped to create in Russia and other Eastern nations a new core of National Socialist communities, which was Himmler's actual plan for the East if war did occur. The East was to be developed into Slavic National Socialist states who would be part of a larger pan-European confederation for the multi-cooperation and betterment and protection of the common Indo-European cultures, peoples, and nations. After the event, the opening of the KGB recorded was the majority of civilian deaths on the Eastern Front, where literally mass liquidations of the Russian and other populaces done by the Bolsheviks, as they knew the populaces were working with the Axis for their mutual liberation and freedoms in the freed areas. Their scorched earth policy was applied to human populations as well. Okay, well, anyway, I believe that was a good spot to stop at anyway. So, that was at the end of a paragraph there. So, let me go back to my notes. And, there's something I wanted to say, and I forgot to say it in my earlier part of my show. Someone had sent me an email earlier this week. It meant to be funny. It says, cows and illegal immigrants. Is it just me, or does anyone else find it amazing that during the mad cow epidemic, our government could track a single cow born in Canada almost 3 years ago right to the stall where she slept in the state of Washington, and they tracked her calves to their stalls, but they are unable to locate 11 million illegal aliens wandering around our country. Maybe we should give each of them a cow. Okay, I thought that was funny. So again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? And I will close out with some final thoughts. Truth does not fear investigation. Belief is when someone else does the thinking. The truth is hate, only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might, but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate. It's about survival. You do not have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want our guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns, only illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. If you worship your enemy, you are defeated. If you adopt your enemy's religion, you are enslaved. If you breed with your enemy, you are destroyed. Ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. There is no higher religion than truth. Religion leads to racial death. Racial death is forever. 1488. So until next time, hail Satan. And we've got to go back to the studio, and I will pick a song here to go out with.
your check, but baby, let me hold the door. We'll go and get my guitar, yeah, so I can play for you some more. I'll